Thank you to you all for the opportunity to come talk to you about something that I'm pretty passionate about. I wish sometimes they'd just let us get up and say, hi, I'm Mike, I'm a physical therapist, and I'd love to talk to you about something I use in my practice that's really effective. So thank you for the opportunity to be with y'all. My family requested one thing. You know, they got to come to Padre with me, and while I'm here with you all, they reminded me that they're on the beach, you know, with the beautiful Gulf. So if I can just get a selfie, if y'all entertain me for a second. I'm pretty bad at this, but I'll try to get different parts of the room just so I can prove to them that I was actually at a talk, that I wasn't just like sitting at Louis or Clayton's or something like that. So I am Mike. I'm a PT. I'm going to try to go through this. Can I just get a feel for what the audience, any PTs in the room? Okay, cool. Any athletic trainers? Okay, figured that was the case. Any physicians? Okay, this is a very broad topic. So what I hope to do, regardless of whether this is something that you can use in your practice or not, I'm going to try to make this very broad as an application type discovery. So that way you get a feel for what types of interventions that are utilized across the spectrum. So I don't care if you're an orthopedic surgeon, primary care sports, athletic trainer, physical therapist, these concepts are applicable across disciplines. So my caveat is always that as a licensed PT, this is in my purview and practice act. You might be an ATC and this is within your practice act. Whatever discipline you are, it's ultimately your professional responsibility to ascertain whether or not this is a part of your practice act. So that's kind of my caveat. So just from a perspective of very global, talking about a very effective, efficacious intervention that is not owned by acupuncturists, and I'll kind of talk about the difference there kind of as we go through things. And I'm pretty informal. I'm high energy and I pace a lot. So if you have questions while we're going, just raise your hand, throw something at my general direction, and I'll do my best to go through, and we'll save some time for questions at the end. So this is kind of a Cliff's Notes version. So if you go through a certification program, like similar to the one I went through, about 27 to 30 hours over a three-day continuing ed course, and they're typically anywhere from 2 to 3 parts. So it's a lot jammed in. You know, you're doing a lot of repetitions, trying to get really confident and comfortable with sticking someone with needles. Sometimes we're more comfortable with that idea than not, depending on your background. But I'm going to try to go through. So I'm an educator. We always have to have objectives. I hope that you guys just get a good feel for what dry needling is, how it's different from acupuncture. And I'm going to try to give some specifics for an athlete population. I work with a lot of performing artists, although they're not your football, basketball, soccer. I consider it kind of like sideline coverage because they're, you know, we're sitting there on the sidelines of their performances waiting for something aberrant to possibly happen, or we're treating them in between performances, and dry needling is one of those interventions that we use pretty frequently. So I'm going to try to interject with some examples from some of the soccer, football, basketball, and dancers that I treat, and then we'll entertain other questions from there. So this is a patient of mine. I wanted to throw this out there and see if there was anyone in the audience that'd want to volunteer for this kind of treatment. All right. This isn't torture. I also treat people with a fair amount of neurological dysfunction. This is a patient that has dystonia. So just a lot of tightness all over the place. And what he's found in trying all these different interventions, baclofen pumps, that actually dry needling is the only thing on a biweekly basis that keeps his tone and pain in check and allows him to work, of all things, as a true ditch digger. This guy's got probably one of the hardest jobs of anybody I know, goes out and digs ditches for the water company for like 60 hours a week. So not only is he going out and beating his body to death, but he's also, you know, trying to manage pain and be a father to his kids and all those kind of things. I also like humor. So I try to throw things in there from time to time. So if anyone's offended, stop me out in the parking lot and you can tell me how offended you are. Okay, so where are we going today? We're going to talk about dry needling. We're going to talk about the difference between dry needling and acupuncture. I'm going to go into some of the kind of the contention between dry needling and acupuncture. Talk about a little bit about trigger points. We're going to talk about the effects trigger points have on the body. We're going to talk about what dry needling does to reduce pain. Talk about how safe it is, because we are introducing a needle into someone's body, so there's always questions about infection and things like that. And then how do we do it? And I'm hopefully going to have an audience participant that'll let me demonstrate them at the very end. Maybe not. Okay, so what is dry needling? It's a technique to treat the neuromuscular system in the presence of muscle tightness, pain, dysfunction. If you really want a pretty good, just concise definition, right from Wikipedia, it's the use of a monofilament needle. So if you look at the difference between an acupuncture needle and a hypodermic needle, so who uses hypodermic needles in, as a part of their regular practice? Okay, so if you think about the gauges of needles, like 18 gauge, 20 gauge, you know, they're made to tear through skin. They're made to tear through, get to the vein or artery, draw blood. I'm not trying to tear through skin. In fact, I'm trying to do the least amount of trauma possible to the skin when I'm trying to utilize dry needling as an intervention. So I tell patients that this is not like going to the doctor and giving blood, which I know you all dread. This is something that we're using a small monofilament needle. So it's like a 0.3 millimeter, third of a millimeter in diameter. It's really sharp at the end, and it's designed to get through as much tissue as possible, causing as little trauma to get to that area of dysfunction. We also call it a dry needle because we're not using any sort of injectable. We're not dipping it in lidocaine, marcaine, bivacaine, anything like that prior to inserting that needle. So we're taking that needle, finding that difficult spot that's pain, stiff, tight, using that needle. In fact, when patients ask me what the main difference between acupuncture and dry needling is, I say acupuncture involves all this, you know, energy, congested flow. Dry needling is we find it, we grab it, we stab it, and then you feel better. Sometimes not always the easiest sell, but at least they get that in their head that this is not acupuncture. So what is the big difference? Anyone give me a good definition of what acupuncture is or involves? Any acupuncturists out there? Okay, so acupuncture is this big field of study grounded in Eastern Oriental medicine. It involves assessments of pulse and tongue and much more than I could ever go into, and has to do with treating areas of congested energy flow called qi that corresponds to different visceral structures and organ dysfunction and changes in your pulse and in your tongue. So they're doing a lot more of a meridian-based approach, more of a very systematic, where dry needling is literally, like I said, grab it and stab it. We're going to find tight, taut areas in the muscle, you know, those bands that are shortened, painful, stiff. We're going to stick a needle into that. One common example I give to people, who here has tightness and stress in their upper shoulders, upper traps? Okay, that's my favorite area to treat because people come in with neck pain, with stiffness. What do we do a lot of, most of us? Sitting at a computer, right? At some point in our existence, we're doing it for work, we're doing it for Facebook, our faces are on our phones, we're in that kind of flexed posture, we're going to get dysfunction in those muscles, and we can have a big effect at decreasing that tightness that we just can't seem to do something with utilizing needling. I said, hopefully this won't be an approach that you're subject to, but... Okay, so what are some common symptoms of dry needling? What do they feel like? Clinically, what I hear most commonly is people report a dull ache or cramp. Pain, stiffness, more described as an ache or a throbbing, postural fatigue, than really sharp pain. Really infrequently do I get sharp pain, radicular symptoms. They may have pain at rest or with motion. They may have stiffness. Could be very difficult to locate. Could be referred pain. And it may be just diffuse, you know, not really related to dermatome or myotome. I like dermatome or myotomal referral patterns because they're really easy to assess. I can treat, and then I can reassess, and I can see an immediate effect. So if I see something that's affecting the C23 dermatome, I can assess that. I can treat that upper trap and all that related musculature. I can reassess using pain and other variables, and then I can tell right away. So patients always think I'm a little crazy when I tell them I expect a 30% change when we use this intervention from baseline on the first visit, because I'm big into patient education and I'm big in delivering what we say we're going to deliver. So when a patient comes to me and I say, I know you've been other places, I know you say that exercise, massage, all these other things that you've tried before don't work, let's try this. And if you can deliver 25 to 30% regardless of your population, you got them hooked. You know, they're going to really be interested in what you have to say and how you have to go about your plan in addressing their dysfunction. And a lot of times it's not related to trauma. So one of my early biases was this must only happen in people post-motor vehicle wreck. You know, had to have been a trauma. That's the only thing that can cause those upper trap or postural muscles to get that jacked up. But then I started seeing this big population on a university campus of administrative professionals, people whose job is to sit at a computer for 30 to 50 hours a week, and none of which have had real great ergonomic assessments done to tell them if that's their ideal sitting posture. So started to do more introspection and investigation into that and found that really this is the common presentation. I see a lot of people that have postural dysfunction and end up with these trigger points. So how do we find them? I use palpation a lot in my practice, just trying to get in there, trying to figure out where things are, trying to see if we can't have a positive impact. A lot of times I use trigger point pressure. So I'll palpate along, say, the upper trap, and if you all did that right now, if you grab your upper trap, you kind of give it that lumbrical pinch, pinch along it. Don't pinch too hard. We don't want to hit a spot where you pass out. Find that one trigger point that feels really tight and just squeeze it for a second or two. You may feel it either jump, like you hit that relaxation point, or you know, it gives it a little bit of a release. You know, so that's sort of what I look for. Or a jump sign like, I put a lot of pressure there and the patient jumps because of pain. So either way, I'm trying to elicit a twitch response. And the underlying is I'm trying to inhibit that overexcitement or overactivity of that muscle, trying to get that to relax and restore normal range of motion. So here's just a depiction of a trigger point. So from the utmost level of the muscle all the way down to that micro layer, I'm really trying to get a feel for what's going on from top to bottom. So if I'm looking layer by layer, I'm gonna palpate for the taut band. What I'm really gonna see is an area, if I look at it under a slide microscope, I'm gonna see areas of sarcomere shortening. Now, most commonly at that myotendinous junction, but shortening nonetheless. And I'm going to be able to visualize a contraction and not. So investigators like Jay Shaw out in Georgia have done some ultrasound-guided imaging over trigger points. And they've actually seen that. We see a trigger point under ultrasound guidance imaging. We can stick a needle into it. We can interrupt that. We can get a twitch response. And we can see those actual muscle fibers relax. So we see a reflexive relaxation of that twitch response. So not only do we theorize it, you know, we can measure the neurotransmitters and chemicals that are present, you know, in the trigger point before and after needling, but we've also seen it under ultrasound guidance. So there's all kinds of different definitions. I ascribe to the Trevell and Simons. Trevell and Simons were physicians that studied trigger point mapping. They'd inject a substance into an area and follow the referred pattern, tend to follow along referred patterns at times, but like I said, not. But the true characteristics are the tight band, like I said, referred tenderness, motor dysfunction, and then there is an autonomic phenomenon. So what do I mean by an autonomic phenomenon? So I'll needle patients from time to time, and they'll go into a hysterical crying or laughing spell. And it's not related to the fact that the needling hurts, it's that somehow we're stimulating the autonomic nervous system. I had a friend a while back with plantar fasciitis, and he wouldn't let me needle him because, you know, your friends never let you treat them. So I had one of my therapists treat him. And within like four visits, we had this chronic plantar fasciitis completely resolved through needling and then a multimodal strengthening and stretching program. The funny thing was, he'd get up off of our table, and it would look like he had a sweat outline where he was laying on the table because of that autonomic nervous system effect. You know, not that he's diaphoretic or anything like that, but we're stimulating some sort of sympathetic nervous system response. And this is where a lot of the literature's going. If you do a Google Scholar search of dry needling and nervous system effects, you'll see a lot of the research that's coming up on the horizon trying to study and understand more of what's occurring, not just from a musculoskeletal perspective, because that's simple, right? I can stick a needle, or if I press and compress something long enough, in a trigger point, I'm going to see a change. These are the effects that I can't necessarily explain. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those chemicals. So how do we find them? We all have different assessments we use. And I'm not saying that one assessment, I like the SFMA and the FMS just because they're multifunctional planes of movement. I don't like range of motion just in isolation because it's non-functional. We don't move in planes of just elbow flexion extension. We move in multiplanar movements, but however you like to do your assessment, one of the things I like to hammer home a lot is treatment effectiveness. And the only way we can get good at really knowing if something is effective in isolation is you assess something, you interventionally treat it, and then you reassess it. So I like to do things like the FMS quickly. I can treat them. I can do a quick post-assessment or break down components of the SFMA or the FMS. And then that tells me right then and there that there was an effect related directly to that intervention or not. And then you can use other things. You know, if you like to measure range of motion, if that is something, or flexibility, neural tension, motor control, and then any type of stability issues. So a couple different ways that I use palpation. You can look at a skin rolling. Skin rolling is if, say, I was along the paraspinals on the right side. Normally, I should be able to roll along the skin. You know, that myofascial layer rolls on top of the muscle pretty nicely. What you tend to find is areas of like glue, where if you see it just doesn't roll smoothly, it tends to bunch up, and you may see that in athletes with like long-term tendinopathies, acute muscle strains. There's autonomic nervous system changes that are also related to that. You can take the end of a reflex hammer or a matchstick, and in that area, you can stick the edge of the the wood part of the matchstick or the edge of the reflex hammer into the skin. Typically, if you did that, you'd see that skin blanch quickly and then, you know, the tone of the skin go back to normal. When we see autonomic nervous system changes, you see those indentations stay for maybe like a minute or two, a little longer than I would anticipate. And then an orange peel, or it's known as the peel de orange, that's just a common appearance in cases where there's an underlying autonomic nervous system component. So the skin takes on an appearance of like an orange peel, if you think about just the inside of an orange. So where do they come from? There's all kinds of theories, and this is just one of the commonly accepted theories from Jay Shaw. It starts off with changes in muscle due to some sort of trauma or overload, most commonly overload injury, leads to decreased energy, tissue hypoxia, leads to an increase of acetylcholine release at the neuromuscular junction, resulting in increased in spontaneous electric activity. Spontaneous electrical activity is just an increase in that resting tone. So anytime we have an increase in the activity of muscle, when I measure it via fine wire or surface EMG, I'm going to see an increase in spontaneous electrical activity. And then over time, that causes prolonged soft tissue adaptation and shortening, which leads to trigger points. Okay, spontaneous electroactivity, we can measure this with needle EMG. Normally, we'd have some action potentials that we might see at rest in just an area that's a little bit of hypertonic possibly, but we're seeing this as a discrete increase in activity. So when I look at that surface EMG printout to the far right, I see that at rest, I should see what's on the lower one, whereas in an area with trigger points, I'm seeing an increase in that activity. And then what we also have seen through work with Shaw, Gunn, and others is that needle EMG has been effective at resulting in that normalized signal. So even if we don't even look at a targeted approach, just stick a needle into an area that's hypertonic has been shown to decrease that electrical activity. So the other part of it is the neurophysiological mechanism. So not only do we have the biomechanical effects, we also have the effects of nociceptive chemicals. So CGRP is calcitonin, gene reactive protein, interleukin, a lot of those inflammatory transmitters increase in concentration, decrease the pH in that environment, that lowers the stimulation for threshold, and that eventually leads to increase in the likelihood of stimulation through things that normally shouldn't be. So kind of that central sensitization that you might be hearing a lot more about in the literature now, a non-painful stimulus that's now painful. So what I hear a lot of times, if someone that's got a really angry trigger point, you know, they wear a tight shirt and that brushes against their upper trap, that elicits a noxious stimulus when in effect normally it shouldn't. So we have a decrease in the stimulation for threshold results in an increase in that stimulation. So the underlying contributor to that is really neurogenic inflammation. Neurogenic inflammation or inflammation to that nervous system, patient's going to report pain and stiffness like we said before. There will be an increase in the resting tone, and we're seeing that through palpation and through stimulation of those peripheral points. So Chan Gunn was a physician in China, and he studied what's known as the reticulopathy model, and has demonstrated this in humans and rats. In effect, he believes that every level of the spine, we have a dermatomal and a myotomal connection, and we can mostly agree to that. But if we stimulate centrally, we'll have an effect peripherally. So he took a bunch of people in rats, studied these shortened sarcomeres, and found, okay, if I stimulate L4 and I stimulate, you know, the quad, I should see an effect both centrally and peripherally. So by stimulating an area around that, not necessarily that exact motor point, and stimulating centrally, I can enact change. So we found that people with negative EMGs, and what kind of started it all, were coming in and reporting less pain overall. I said that the neuropathy must be the underlying cause of pain, that there must be some sort of degenerative change that occurs at the level of the spine. Level of the spine, degenerative changes, compresses that spinal nerve, and that has an effect on the peripheral nerve. And then the ensuing result is muscle shortening. So people that you'll see, and they'll label themselves as gun practitioners, are grounded in the model where they're not just going to treat a peripheral area like I commonly do. They'll treat centrally and they'll treat peripherally. And you're seeing more and more of this type of research in pain science. As we look for pain distributions and we look at pain mapping and we see how a central stimulation increases a peripheral stimulus and how that can become more noxious over time, we're looking at ways, how can we treat more globally instead of locally to enact more change? So there's all kinds of effects of how dry needling is associated to how the brain processes pain. So we get the pain fibers, afferents of myelinated and unmyelinated 3 and 4 fibers that bring pain. It's mediated by the periaqueductal gray. As a result of that pain stimulus, we have increase in somatosensory cortex, increase in limbic system. So what does that correlate to? Muscles get tight and our emotional response is heightened because our limbic system's kind of our fight or flight, oh crap, something's about to happen or something's going on, I can't explain it, my panic system. So that's that. We get a decrease in the hypothalamic activity, so our kind of homeostasis mechanism decreases, and a decrease in the hippocampus activity. So we get this onset of pain, we start to go in that fight or flight, we actually get a suppression of pain memory, which I think is really interesting, and there's been some cool studies that have come out to look at how people recall prior pain experiences, even if it's the same type pain. So I see this a lot in my practice with chronic pain. I'll treat someone repetitively over the course of maybe, say, 6 months, and it's very intermittent. I see them for a couple weeks, we treat them, we modulate their pain, they go back into their life. Of course, like most of our patients, clients we interact with, they stop doing the things that we tell them to do, that they get back into their routines, and they come back almost in a sense of panic, greater in pain presentation than the time before. And when I've looked into a lot of the research, a lot of it's related to that decrease in that hippocampus activity and activation. They forget what that pain experience was like. So I do a lot of patient education to try to talk them down off the cliff right away to be like, okay, time out. Remember, this was the same pain that you felt, you know, 3, 6, 9 months ago. It's just a new onset from doing the same activity. It's just a little bit more, you know, acute in its presentation this time, and try to talk them through that. So what does dry needling do to reduce pain? Other than just the biomechanical of, I feel there's a trigger point, I stick a needle into it, relaxes that muscle. What else is going on? So what studies have found is that needling just in general, in a diffuse area, actually causes a decrease or an inhibition of central nervous system activity. So whether or not I'm really specific, or whether or not I just think, okay, I kind of know anatomy, kind of want to stick some needles in people, I'm just going to do it in a general area. Both have been shown to cause a demonstrable change. Superficial needling tends to activate limbic system. So you're getting a little bit of kind of a decrease in that emotional response just from superficial needling, and that's been shown. The deeper we go with needling, especially towards bone, we tend to get more CNS activation. So if you think about it, the outer lining of the periosteum of the bone is very highly innervated. So it makes sense to me, if I stimulate something that's got a lot of afferent input, I'm going to get a change. And we see that clinically. And then just overall, improvement in just quality of perceived quality of life, improvement in just their overall emotional mood. And I see this on a day-to-day basis. Somebody will come in, especially someone with chronic pain. There's depressive. There might be manic episodes related to that. I take an assessment, maybe using the SF-12 or some sort of quality of life index, pre versus post treatment, and in most cases, we'll see a change, even just in general mood. Give me a couple descriptors of your mood now versus your mood after, and it could have been, yeah, not great, you know, slightly depressed, just feeling achy, and then afterwards, feel a lot better, less pain, feel like I can go out and do more, I feel less fatigue, and all of those are then indicative of some of those nervous system. And then there's just the local effects, more biomechanical, decrease in spinal cord reflex, we get increase in blood flow to the area, decrease in those present neurotransmitter chemicals, increase in restoration of levels of those reactive nociceptive proteins. So what I always tell people is there's kind of a three-pronged approach. There's a mechanical reaction, there's a chemical, and then there's an electrophysiological reaction. And mechanical is the immediate muscle's tight, muscle becomes relaxed. Chemical is all of the proteins and nervous system effects, and then electrophysical is kind of that a combination of all of those different variables that we can measure using EMG. So different depths do achieve different results. What I tell people all the time, especially new needlers and patients, we're going to go deep or we're going to go home. I like bone as a backdrop because it's safe. Okay, I think I could teach I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old daughter. I think I could teach them how to dry needle someone. They wouldn't understand the reasoning or the application, but the art of manipulating a needle and sticking that into someone is not skillful. Knowing when, knowing why, knowing where, knowing, you know, the indications, contraindications, precautions, that's where the real skill in this comes. So as you're thinking about things, there's some really great apps out there. Essentially, and I'm not promoting anything, I'm just telling you what I use in my practice. There's no conflict or anything like that. But if you search on the App Store, the Android Store, there's some really great anatomical apps that you can find out there. One of the great things about that is you actually look at a person anatomically in situ. It's really hard for me to conceptualize a Netter's Atlas or a Gray's Atlas of anatomy and try to use that as patient education and then to correlate to 3D dimensional anatomy. So a lot of those apps out there, and offline I can answer some questions about those specifically, are great because I can show a patient exactly layer by layer what I'm going through. I can show them on my portable device, okay, I'm going to needle your deltoid, and to do that, this is the dermis and epidermis. I'm going to reflect that. This is the middle deltoid, reflect that. This is down to the humerus, and the only precaution I have is that posterior circumflex artery. And once patients see that, clients, whatever, there's a lot less anxiety to the approach because they see, I'm getting over the initial fear of you sticking me with a needle. I know you know what you're doing because you know your anatomy and you're able to, express it really well. And I know that the likelihood of an adverse event is really low. So just really driving that home. And all those different effects that we said all the way down to bone. So a couple different things that we talked about, in terms of the deeper the signal, the deeper the CNS effect. I'm going all the way down to bone. You can do some perineural effects if you're really looking for a very strong. And then one of the things I've started using in my practice, probably in the last year and a half, 2 years, I've been using this for about 5 years, is utilizing an e-stim application. You can use a microcurrent pulse stimulator, or you can use like a neuromuscular stim unit with alligator clips. You can drop needles into an area, stim it, and both the effects as well as the immediate and post-carryover effects are significantly increased compared to, before needling. So it tends to enhance the effect. Really learned it early on, more anecdotally. I learned this new skill. Who do you practice on most of all when you learn a new skill? Your family members. So I went home to my wife and I said, I learned this new skill. Can I needle your upper traps? And she said, sure. So the first couple times, needled both sides. And afterwards, she said, I really don't want you to do that anymore because it's making me worse. I'm more sore as a result of it. So why don't you go back, practice on your patients, get really good, and then come back? Well, I was seeing the same effect in my patients. So I was like, well, my wife wasn't just being nice. She was telling me that this was really painful. My patients say the same thing. So started using e-stim and noticed almost an 80% reduction in that post-needling soreness. The effect was magnified that much more because of that deeper CNS activation. So when do you see effects? Tends to be right away. And one of the things that I hammer home a lot of times is regardless of your application and, the way that you tend to look at things based off your training, we never utilize this in isolation. I'm never just needling. So I'm not an acupuncturist, and I make that known. I'm a physical therapist that utilizes this in my practice. So I never utilize this in isolation. Okay, so how safe is it? This is a question I get a lot of times. You're asking me to go out potentially to either become, certified in this or to expose myself. I'm also a proponent. I never do anything clinically unless I've been exposed to it, just because I don't want a patient to start saying something like, oh, is this normal? And me to sit there like, oh, I don't know. You want to be able to speak to the normal effects, and the best way to do that is to have this done. It's also a plug for someone to volunteer at the very end. Let's hope that none of you ever get this bored in your job. Okay, so how safe is needling? So unfortunately, dry needling's been around for about 50 years, 60 years, but acupuncture's been around for thousands of years. So most of the adverse event data has focused on acupuncture, and this one study looked at acupuncture adverse events reported in China over a 72-year period. A total of almost 1,200 cases, and the most commonly cited adverse effect was soft tissue injuries. We had pneumothorax, and I'll talk a little bit about that. When you look at the relative risk of needling compared to other interventions, needling is actually safer than therapeutic exercise in an athlete population. It's safer than spinal manipulation in the C-spine. So when we think about things, relative risk, risk-benefit ratios and things like that, a skilled person that knows where they're sticking a needle is actually safer than someone that might not be skilled in applying therapeutic exercise as a dosing drug. So I find that to be really interesting, because this is a heck of a lot more invasive than having someone do, you know, a higher level of exercise, but the application is the important part. And it's not in this slide, but in one it said injuries of the medulla oblongata and needling the foramen magnum. I don't know what that treatment approach is, but I don't use that in my practice. Okay, most important thing is know your anatomy. So I use a lot of upper trap needling. I don't ever stick a needle down into the upper part of the upper trap. A lot of times, upper trap, lat, we're pulling the muscle away. Why do you think that is? Lung. So in like 85 to 90% of people, the apex of the lung actually extends above the clavicle. So I want to, anything I'm treating, the lat, you know, I want to be mindful of that outer lung tissue. I don't want to introduce purposely a needle into the lung. So just know your anatomy. Know about where things are. Know that, you know, about T9, T10 is where I'm going to find the liver. Know, you know, how far down the lungs extend down from the superior and then to the lower lobe. Tells you a lot about just, you know, depth and goals of achievement. There are some relative contraindications, and these are just kind of gospel and verse. They are what they are. Inadequate knowledge or denied consent. The conversation's over. If a patient just automatically, no way in hell, you're not coming at me with a needle, they have a significant needle phobia, it's off the table, I'm going to try something else. And I don't care if that's, you know, Mrs. Smith that's 85 years old or my 18-year-old sideline athlete. We're just looking for something else. Lack of sterility. Also make it known that this is not a sterile technique. I'm not creating a sterile field in an OR. I use clean needle technique. I prep the skin. I wear gloves. You know, we're utilizing as much precaution as we can to decrease the likelihood of infection, but it's not a sterile technique. The needles also come prepackaged in sterile packaging, but again, it's not a sterile technique. Pregnancy in the first trimester, I have a general rule of thumb. I don't even like to breathe on patients that are in that first trimester, just for my own comfort zone, because there's so many adverse events that can happen. So I avoid that. People with bleeding disorders on anticoagulants, people that are significantly immunosuppressed, for whatever reason, umbilicus, nipples, external genitalia, unless that's your thing, over joint replacements, implants, cardiac pacemakers, and spinal stimulants, just for common sense. And then there's a general protocol that's pretty accepted. I know a lot of you work very closely with orthopedic surgeons, so I tend to run this by them before I start sticking needles into their surgical areas. Typically, for adjacent structures, it's 6 weeks, and over the direct site, 12 weeks postoperatively. So an example, I work very closely in my primary practice in the DFW area with a well-known shoulder surgeon. A lot of those patients are in abduction splints or slings for a good 4 to 6 weeks. They get a lot of upper trap tightness. So I've gone to him and said, you know what, post-op week 4, 5, 6, if they're cool and, you know, they're progressing okay, is it okay if we hit that upper trap with a needle? You know, you did a rotator cuff repair, our risk of relative infection is really low because the upper trap doesn't even communicate with the shoulder girdle, and they're pretty accepting of it. You know, you get a total joint surgeon and you want to start sticking needles in the quads and that opens up to the knee, there's a much higher relative risk of infection. So whether you're recommending this or utilizing this in your day-to-day practice, the caveat I always give is the surgeon owns the protocol, so just communicate with them and see what they're comfortable with. Couple types of piercings out there. Relative precautions and just things to be aware of. Anything along the lung field, just know your depth. I needle the intercostals, I'll needle the rectus, the obliques. I just have to know how deep I'm going to go, so make sure I don't introduce a needle into that. The iliac crest, just make sure you're not going into the peritoneal cavity. The sacral, coccyx, or buttocks, for whatever obvious reasons. Neurovascular bundles, so especially the femoral triangle, the cubital fossa. You can stick a needle into the femoral triangle. There's a lot of great applications treating pectineus on the floor of the triangle, treating the conjoined tendon of iliacus and psoas minor. So don't be afraid of it. Just know what the precautions are and just be trained in that approach. Worst case scenario, say you hit an artery or a nerve. We don't want to gun for them. We're not trying to be a sniper and go for the femoral artery. It's a very, very small, I said a third of a millimeter in diameter needle. The likelihood that that's going to cause trauma and insult and cause this huge bleed out is very small. Keep in mind, too, that arteries do have smooth muscle, so it's not uncommon for them to report a deep ache that's not consistent with what I would feel. So normally, I'll stick a needle in someone, and they'll say, you know, that's just a deep ache, kind of uncomfortable, almost like, you know, butterflies in your stomach locally. But when they start to report, that's like a sharp, intense ache, it doesn't feel good, it doesn't feel right, typically are signs that you've either hit an artery or a vein. Nerve, it's going to be simple. It's going to zing. So if you hit a nerve root in the lumbar spine, thoracic spine, you hit a peripheral nerve, you're going to get a quick zinger along that distribution. You back the needle out, you go right back after it, and move on. And what I always tell patients when that happens, I meant to do that. That was just an extra part of the treatment. I'm not going to charge you any more for that. But you're going to feel better as a result of me doing that. Common complications. So needle insertion, of course, is going to be the most common effect. You know, I stick a needle in someone, of course it's going to hurt. I may have a vasovagal response. This is also why I never needle someone in standing. Probably seems pretty obvious, but the training course that I went through and that I teach with, they used to have people stick themselves and then stick each other as kind of that initial needle stick. What they found were very high rates of vasovagal reactions, people fainting in their chairs. If this does happen, just like if it happens on the sidelines, you get them laying down, you throw their legs up above the level of their heart, you shove some ammonia in their face, and before you know it, they're back to their senses. So not a big deal, and I try not to, even if it happens, trying to make a big deal out of it to the patient. You know, a lot of times they're embarrassed. Forgotten needles, needles that get stuck, that does happen. There's some really aggressive winding techniques. You drop a needle in, you wind it up. Well, if you think about it, anytime you wind something up, that's going to cause the tissue to go with it because the needle's there. So if you wind that needle up, that paraspinal tissue, bicep tissue is going to wrap around that. Well, if that muscle is really tight, that needle might get stuck. Not a big deal. Drop a couple other needles around it, stimulate it, and a lot of times we'll get that muscle to relax and back that needle back out. Needles do break. It doesn't happen very often. I've seen it in the acupuncture literature. Fatigue, bruising, and infection are also common. Infection, very low rates, but you always want to educate people about all of the possible effects that can happen after an intervention. Common signs of pneumothorax, and you all know this. This is a medical emergency. I haven't had this happen. This has been reported. Somebody left the clinic. You know, we've heard stories of it. They call you back, or they leave the whatever environment you treated them. They say, you know, I kind of feel a little fatigued, but I also feel a little short of breath. And you think back, and you're like, man, yeah, I treated their upper traps. I treated their lats, their rhomboids. You know what? Just take a trip to the ER. Get a chest x-ray. Make sure everything's cool. Call me back after it's done. Let's make sure that, and then I just own it. I could say personally, if this happened to me, I would sit down with the patient and say, you know, this is not what I was going for. This is just a relative risk of the intervention. You know, I would not try to say, oh, it's probably something that you did after you left here. You probably tried to lift too strenuously. Just own it, move beyond it, and you know, keep that patient's trust going. Call 911, transport them to the ER. So what I'm going to go through just really quickly is kind of a how-to, finish with a demonstration, and then leave plenty of time for questions. So getting started. So I make sure that I'm in a distraction-free environment. I know, having worked in them in the past, I know what sidelines are like. I know what clinics are like. I know what training rooms are like. They're noisy. There's a whole lot going on. So I don't do a lot of needling. Even if I'm backstage at Bass Hall in Fort Worth with the ballet company I work with, I'm not sitting on stage on the side during a performance trying to sit there and dry needle someone's adductor. I take them down into a room where it's a lot quieter, where I can actually think and then apply that intervention. So try to minimize distraction, because I know in your environments there's a million things going on at any one time, but you're sticking needles in people. So if you're going to do that, you want to make sure that you can do it and not have 10 million other things going on. Make it so that way they're comfortable. If you have someone in a position where they're not comfortable and they're guarding, that's going to automatically decrease the likelihood of your successive intervention. Make sure you can access everything. You don't want to have to get in a position where, like, you're over the table, standing on one leg, you know, trying to expose the glute. Get everything ready beforehand, and then position yourself so there's no barriers between you and the patient. I recommend a lot of times when I teach that people get a cart, just like you'd have a cart that has all your supplies, whatever types of supplies you use. Everyone is very methodical, I know, in the way that they do things, whether you're whatever. You know, you're applying your interventions, you're getting everything ready, you're minimizing distractions, because you have to be efficient in all of our environments to be successful. So that's what I at least recommend. This is kind of a typical starter kit. There is evidence to say that using gloves or not using gloves doesn't matter, that the bacteria on the skin really doesn't directly relate to the likelihood of a staph infection or skin infection from introducing foreign objects into the skin, so that's been pretty interesting to see. I use them in my practice because I just believe in universal precautions. If I treat everyone the same, no one can ever claim that I was biased against them. I treated them differently. I don't care if you're, you know, normal, healthy, you know, 17-year-old football player, or if you're, you know, 50-year-old, million comorbidities, Hep C, HIV, whatever, y'all are being treated the same. you know, and then, like I said, and then all different needle sizes, needle types. So needles come packaged in a couple different ways, and I'll show a couple examples. They come prepackaged in these single-use tubes, which are pretty common, and they come packaged in what's known as blister packs. So we see a lot of times where you'll either have prepackaging, and I'll pass a couple of these around just so anyone that's interested can get a feel for what those are like. Get this open today. It's not a controlled substance, so I'm not really all too worried. It's the beautiful thing about being a PT. I don't deal with drugs, so y'all want to pass those around and just get a feel for what that's like. We'll start off on one here. Go to this side. You guys can just get a feel for what that needle's like and how small they are if you want to pass those around. So I look at a lot of times that are named by two numbers. And if you look on the back of that packaging, and you can just pass that around, they're usually named by a point something. So 0.15, 0.2, 0.3. That's the diameter. So really, really small. And they're in millimeters. They're all usually found in millimeters. And then they're going to have a full number. So 15, 25. Commonly, we're going to see 50s, kind of right in the middle there, 60s, 75s, and 125s. So, you know, depending on the application, I might use different size needles. So 50 millimeters is what? 2.5 centimeters is 1 inch. So if you think about relative depths, you know, I think in terms of millimeters, but I wasn't raised in the metric system, and I try to convert that a lot of times if patients have questions of this is my target depth tissue. You know, I want to treat the glute med, so I need to get down to that glute. I want to treat the lumbar paraspinals. I need to use the appropriate muscle to achieve that depth. Did you have a question, sir? Okay. So, you know, we'll use that for the application. You can use gloves. You don't have to. It's not uncommon for acupuncturists to use, they're called finger cots, or some of my students call them finger condoms. Use those. Use gloves. I like to use nitrile gloves because they're non-latex. There are a fair amount of people out there that have latex allergies, so it's just something to be aware of. But however you use it, get everything ready. Needles will come according to two different types. There's a J-type and an L-type. J-types have a metal handle to them. I don't know if you can see that real well, and they have that little plastic tab like the one I passed around. L-types have a plastic handle to them. The plastic handle will be glued to the side of the guide tube. So one of the biggest things to get used to needling early on is just getting that stupid little tab out of that guide tube or breaking that and keeping the needle bracketed against the side of the guide tube. Probably the single hardest thing in just terms of manipulation early on, because you drop a lot of needles, and once you drop a needle on the ground, that needle's no good. You don't want it to hit the ground and then stick it into someone. That's just bad practice. So there's take that plastic tube out, bracket it against the side of the guide tube. Okay, so we did all that. You feel really comfortable. If you do get into needling, this is something you can do in your practice. One thing I recommend that you do early on, before you start sticking people, get an orange or a banana. Get yourself a hold. You can log on to, there's a couple companies out there, but if you did a Google search for or Amazon search for acupuncture needles, they're out there. You just need to prove that you're a licensed health professional. Get a hold of a banana, an orange or like a peach, something with a tough skin that you can poke through that resembles something. I like oranges and bananas because that tough skin is kind of like poking through the epidermis. And then just get used to bracketing that needle against the side of the guide tube, getting to the edge of the skin with a guide tube, pushing or tapping that down into the skin, and then advancing the needle and getting used to advancing at a good rate. Advancing the needle is kind of like, I liken it to Goldilocks. I don't want to go too fast. I don't want to go too slow. I want to go just right. If you go too fast, it's uncomfortable. If you go too slow, it's uncomfortable. So I want to have just the right speed and amplitude. So by amplitude, I mean if I'm going through and passing strokes, I want to be a lot more like Yo-Yo Ma and a lot less like Charlie Daniels, just so that's more comfortable for the patient. A couple different techniques. There's a vibration technique where you have the needle and you're just vibrating to get that needle down through the skin. There's a pressure technique where you're putting a lot of pressure, a lot of tactile input. We know that people like tactile input. That's why, you know, the compression sleeves, all those things work really well. So to give a broad hand palpation, give them a little bit of pressure. Sometimes, like in the case of the upper trap, the lat, I'll do what's known as a pinch technique. I'll get my lumbricals. I'll pull that tissue away and, you know, give them some pressure. If someone does have some hypersensitivity just in that area because of just that heightened pain response, sometimes I'll just go in and scratch the area with the edge of the guide tube, just decrease some of that sensitization. Not uncommon when I'm teaching new needlers, they might feel an early restriction in like the lumbar paraspinals, and they're like, nope, I feel like I'm to lamina there, I'm good. Just back that needle out if you hit a barrier, especially if you know your depth is right, you know where you should be, just drive that on through. And if it's painful, you get a noxious stimulus, I just pull out right away, wait a couple seconds, try again. Pain should decrease, but if it doesn't, just move on to something else. Needle removal, as you pull a needle out of the skin, it's gonna do what's known as tenting. It's gonna pull the skin up with it. So a lot of times I'll just put that same broad pressure around the area of the needle, back that needle out, and then just dispose of it. Needles are really cheap. It's not like a hypodermic needle. You can usually get 100 needles for like $9. So I don't advocate reusing them. I just single use and then toss them. Okay, a couple things to keep in mind. Bleeding is normal. Hematomas are normal. We have a lot of diffuse capillaries under the skin. So I tell people if they do get a little weal or hematoma, totally normal. Ice it, put direct pressure on it. It's going to go away and get reabsorbed in a couple days. If you do have that blood, get a Kleenex or get a cotton ball, direct pressure over it for 5 seconds or so, just like anything else. Try to avoid touching the shaft of the needle when you are advancing it. You want anything that's going to go into the patient, you don't want that to be introduced. You don't want to have any hands on that. And there's a quick rule of thumb. Remember how many needles you put in. It's just kind of a good rule. You don't want people to go home. And like I said, most important, whatever you do in terms of your assessment or interventions, I always drive home when I talk to groups, assess, treat, and then reassess. That way you can truly tell what was most effective. This is just a quick reference. This is what I use in my practice as kind of a really generalized screen. I like dermatomes and myotomes because if I do see a true dermatomal myotome connection, I can jump in right away. I don't have to test everything. I can test what I think is directly related to the dysfunction quickly. I can treat them, I can retest, and then I know from a motor perspective, you know, what sort of functionality they have. Then I can go ahead and look at some of my other tested measures. And there's upper quadrant myotomes, and those should be in your handouts. If not, I'm happy to send those to Natalie. So anyone want to volunteer? All right, come on up. One brave soul. Okay, so two applications that I probably use most frequently. I'm Mike.
Hi, I'm Morgan.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Okay, so Morgan's nice enough. What sorts of pain do you have in your upper traps?
Okay.
Can you take your hat off for me?
Yeah.
Okay. Got to fix it up. I understand.
Okay,
so we're going to say that Morgan came in and saw me in clinic. So one thing that I would quickly ask her to do is just stand statically, hands at her side, facing straight ahead. Okay, right away, I just take quick note of clinically, you know, what do we got going on? We got one shoulder that's higher than the other. Are you left-handed or right-handed? Right-handed. Okay, so you can see right hand is a little higher. We typically see that a little lower. Okay, and then the other quick thing that I'll ask her to do is, can you just go ahead and look to the right and look to the left? Okay, so we see one more time to the right. Okay, and then one more time to the left. Okay, so pretty limited going to the left as compared to the going to, yeah, okay. Where do you have more soreness, on the right or to the left? On the left. Okay, so let's treat the left. So we don't have a treatment table, so we're going to utilize this table as our treatment table. Can I have you come on up here for me? It'll hold. Just to grab a seat on the table. We're going to sit right here. So typically, I would try to get her in supine. I'm not optimistic that these tables are sturdy enough for us to do that, just for anybody. So what I would do a lot of times is make sure that I could tolerate, or they would tolerate needling well, okay? So keep in mind, the apex of the lung extends up above the clavicle, so I wanna get that area exposed, so a lot of times I'll say, can you take this side of your shirt off? Okay, I'm gonna utilize a posterior approach, so y'all can see, you can utilize an anterior approach as well. What I was advocating for before, get to where I can actually expose the area, where, you know, I'm not trying to like hold the shirt, I have this down, I can get to the area I wanna treat. Okay, we see that automatically resulted in that jump sign, okay? And that's a typical jump sign. A lot of times I'll hold that for a second or two. You okay with that? Okay. Not so I'm trying to elicit a pain response, just so I can get a good feel for how she's gonna tolerate, okay? I know that that's an area of tightness, I can palpate over that. I can drop that needle into that area, okay? I know this is totally safe, There we go. I got a twitch. You feel that?
Yeah.
Okay. So I know that this is safe. I'm away from the clavicle. I'm pulling that upper trap away from her. I'm needling back towards my thumb. I'm utilizing what I call a lumbrical grip. So that way I know it's totally safe. And then my goal is to get that response. And then I believe if I'm going to do something noxious, I'm going to do something nice. And I'm just going to go ahead and just quickly massage that area just to decrease some of that tightness. So can I have you stand up for me? How does that tightness feel now compared to... Okay, feel a little less tight, same? Okay, so let's face them. Let's look at it statically. This isn't like some dog and pony trick. This is just quick application. Okay, how about looking to the right and looking to the left? Okay, that's what I try to show people on a day-to-day basis in my practice. Like, look, this isn't just me up here as a snake oil salesman trying to sell you on something that works. Like, this works. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give her a round of applause. So I guess in closing, it's a really powerful tool when it's used for the right applications. I think it's part of a team. I can tell you that I work very closely. My performing arts team includes a performing arts medicine physician. We have athletic trainers on our team. We have an exercise physiologist. We have physical therapists. We have physical therapist assistants. We all have different roles we play on the team. So even if you're directly doing this or you're recommending this, I think it's really important to be aware of the whole myriad of interventions that you know are out there, whether it's dry needling, whether it's spinal manipulation, whether it's some sort of multimodal exercise program. It's incumbent upon us as providers of a multi-interdisciplinary team to be aware of things that are out there that can best benefit the populations that we interact with. So just in closing, it's a tool. Don't ever utilize it in isolation. And then remember your correctives and patient education, because I think that's where the key to preventing significant recurrence in the future lies. Let's get them early. Let's treat them early. Let's treat them appropriately with dosing. Let's get them, you know, back into those normal, you know, healthy movement patterns, and let's get them back to their activities, whether it's sport, function, life, etc. And thank you for letting me speak to y'all today. Question. So question was, what's the typical time I leave the needle in? And that's about as variable as the techniques, depending on who you're trained by. So for a quick application like that, I just in and out really quickly. A couple seconds. I want to see a demonstrable change. I want to know that, you know, I could both palpate and observe that change and then have an assessment component. But if, say, it's chronic low back pain, I would drop needles in. I would stimulate that using just regular neurostim, interferential, leave that in there for about 10 to 15 minutes like I would normal stim. The application doesn't change if you're using electrodes versus indwelling needles. The time, all that type of stuff to achieve an effect, it's just a more direct approach. Great question. Other questions? Yes, sir. That's a great question. So I don't know the answer to that question. I wish I could say that. Are you permitted by your practice act would be my first question. And then there are entities out there that will certify multi-varied professions like OT, athletic training, PT. Some are just MD-DO. Some get certified in conjunction with a physician. So I do know some colleagues of mine that have gone through a training program like, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, Dr. Ma. Has a program. Sue Falsone is a PT-ATC, does a lot of instruction with them, and they have teams of people that'll go a lot of times, but that would be something I would first start with your practice act and then start with the different entities. I have no problem if it's me as a PT, you know, teaching ATCs how to dry needle because you're part of the team. So if you're permitted to and your practice act allows it, I think every professional should practice to the extent of their training, but that's just the world according to Mike. That and a quarter probably won't even get you a Coke in the gift shop. So anything, other questions at all? Happy to answer. Well, feel free to shoot me an email if you have questions. You can find me on Twitter. That's where I spend most of my time when I'm not with my family. So thank you again, and safe travels.